Actually, this is just kind of a trial run for me. I'm in Fort Worth, and one of the missionaries from Singapore came over to listen to me teach the 2-7 training clinic. We teach leadership training clinics to equip people to do discipleship groups in churches, and one of my responsibilities with the navigators is leading those clinics. And I said, boy, I sure would like to go back to Singapore with you to kind of get you going over there. And he said, well, to tell you the truth, he said, don't take this personally. He said, we speak English in Singapore, but your accent may give you a little problem. So they wouldn't let me go to Singapore, but a friend of mine is in the First Baptist Church in Borger, and he let me come up to Borger. And so now, see, I'm working my way out to Singapore to see if my accent's going to hold up. But the first thing I really need to teach you all is some English. You may have heard Gene use the phrase when he said, y'all sit down. Did you hear that one? Okay, now, the proper spelling for that is Y-A apostrophe L-L, y'all. But it's pronounced Y-A-W-L, y'all. We'll see y'all later. See, you got it? All right, now I want you to let me hear it. I want one, three. One, two, three, y'all. That ain't bad. Ain't so bad. Ain't so bad, as they say. We have a bumper sticker down our way. It says F-O-A-T, Fort Worth, W-U-R-T-H-I-A-H, love, L-U-V-Y-E-W, Fort Worth, I love you. So if things get a little too, if my Texanese gets a little out of hand here tonight, you just ask me what I said, and I'll try to translate it into New England English. Everybody have a handout. I'm just going to kind of go down the list here and make a few comments. And I'm not a politician making a speech. I'm not a preacher giving a sermon. I'm a professor, and I'm accustomed to people raising their hands and asking questions. And I have to deal with those in the classroom, and I would sure welcome any questions or interaction you might have as we go along here. But I'm just going to try to work my way through the outline and make some comments on it. You can take some notes, and if the Lord's in it, we'll finish up at 9 o'clock just like we're supposed to. It's been said that Jesus and his teaching talked more about money than he did about heaven, hell, or eternal life. Now, money doesn't make us or break us. It simply reveals us. In fact, it's been said that how well we manage our money, time, and relationships is going to determine how well we manage our lives. Now, I need to point out there that Jesus may not have been teaching specifically about money. He may have been using an illustration involving money to teach a truth about some other area. But I think the fact that he talked about it so much means that it's important, and there's some lessons there that we can learn from it. Certainly we want to take a look at that. But now, why did Jesus come? Mark 10:45, one of the verses that was quoted by Gene, I think, this afternoon in one of our meetings, the Son of Man, he was encouraging us to serve you all. He said, you all, y'all, he was encouraging us to serve y'all. He said, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So Jesus came to what? To serve and to save. Not to be served, but to serve and to save and to give his life as a ransom for many. Luke 5:32, it says, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I came not to call the righteous, those who think they're in good shape, those who think they're well, came not to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. In 19:10, he said, the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. So Jesus came to seek, to suffer. Jesus came to serve, to suffer, and to save. But as a result of his doing that, in John 10:10, which is one of the passages that we want to look at in some detail here, John 10:10, Jesus said, the thief comes only to steal, and kill, and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. Now, the question arises is, what is abundant life? Now, you may have heard somebody sometimes say that eternal life is quantity of life, and abundant life is, eternal life is quantity of life, but abundant life is quality of life. And that's a pretty good argument, and I used to think that made a lot of sense, and I liked it. But I was meditating on this passage here one time, and it dawned on me that Jesus has told us in this passage what abundant life is. So let's take a look at the whole passage. Let's go John 10, 1 through 10, and you follow along as I read this, and then I'll make a couple of comments to it. Truly, truly, I say to you. Now, the you here is who? Well, no, the you here in this one. Well, now, let's be careful. Some of the Pharisees in 940 came near him, etc. Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you. So he's talking to the Pharisees here, and as we work our way through this, it's important that we keep that in mind. So, truly, truly, Jesus said, I say to you Pharisees, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door but climbs in by another way, that man's a thief and a robber. But, and we've got a contrast here, he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the gatekeeper opens, the sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads, not drives, leads them out. When he has brought out all his own, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. A stranger they will not follow, but they will flee from him, for they do not know the voice of strangers. This figure Jesus used with them, but they did not understand what he was saying to them. So Jesus is saying something to them here in a figure, a parable, a riddle, something that is not a flat-out statement. They didn't understand it. So, it says in verse 7, Jesus said again. They didn't get it, so he's going to come at the same idea again in another way so they can understand it maybe. Truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not heed them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they might have life and have it abundantly. Now here was the thing, and I'd read this passage and was familiar with it, and all of a sudden as I was meditating on this thing one day, it just dawned on me. It wasn't one day, it was about 2 o'clock in the morning. I had a Sunday school class at 9 o'clock, and I was going to ask them one question. What is abundant life? That was the way we were going to start the Sunday school lesson. So, I was looking at that, and in verse 9 it says, if anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. Now, Jesus has been comparing himself, you see, to this thief. Now, the thief, instead of, if you enter by Jesus, you're saved and you go in and out and find pasture. If you enter by the thief, you wound up stolen, killed, or destroyed. Jesus said, I came that they may have life, be saved, and that they may have it abundantly. Go in and out and find pasture. Do you see? And it dawned on me that Jesus said abundant life is going in and out and finding pasture. Following him, he leads, you hear his voice, and you follow him. And so I began to meditate on that, and I thought, well now, what does it mean to go in and out and find pasture? To be a sheep, to follow a shepherd who leads and cares for you, who's not a hireling, who's willing to lay down his life for you, etc. Now, I got the picture in this sheep, see? And I thought, that sheep has got to be one of the most contented things there is. And so it dawned on me...
Must be one of what
things? Most contented.
Oh, contented.
Contented.
I have 2 sheep and a little baby lamb, so the Lord's been teaching me about...
Yeah, contented, see? Yeah. Going in and out and finding pasture. How much more contented could you be? And so then it brought to mind a study that I'd done in the New Testament on the word content. And there's only about 4 or 5 times that word is used in the New Testament. Now let's look up those passages. Just read the passages, and then I'm going to ask you, based on these passages in the New Testament, some of them from the words of Jesus himself, what does it mean to be content? Let's take a look at it. The first one is 1 Timothy 6:8. Somebody finds that before I do, go ahead and read it. 1 Timothy 6, 8.
Shoot. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that.
Right. And the first part of that verse says, we brought nothing into the world, and it's certain that we can't take anything out of the world. But if we have food and clothing, with these we shall be content. Okay, Luke, I'm sorry, Philippians 4:11. Let's see, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians 4:11. Yeah, Philippians 4:11.
Not that I speak in respect for want, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am, wherewith to be content.
Okay, now let's just kind of take a look at that. Not that I complain of want, but I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, and I know how to be abound. In any and all circumstances, I've learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and want. And what is the secret of doing that? Be content. That's the secret. Okay? Hebrews 13:5. Okay. Now, would somebody read that in another version? Did you start with 5? You said, keep your life free from covetousness and what did you say?
And be content with such things as you have.
Okay, and be content with such things as you have. Okay, somebody else read that in another version.
Keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have, because God has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you.
Keep your life free from the love of money, in other words, covetousness, and be content with what you have. Okay? And finally, boy, this is a killer, Luke 3:14. Luke 3:14.
Soldiers who asked him, and we, what shall we do? And he said to them, rob no one by violence or by false accusation, and be content with your wages.
Be content with your wages. All right, now, you cannot find any other time in the New Testament where the word content is used. What does it mean to be content? To have abundant life, to go in and out and find pasture. Based on these scriptures. For if we have food and clothing, with these we shall be content. And whatever state I find myself, I've learned the secret of being content. Keep your life free from the love of money. Be content with what you have, and be content with your wages.
The Lord just gave me a verse that says, godliness with contentment is great gain.
That's the one right after 6:8, I believe, or 6:9 there in 1 Timothy. Yeah, I think that's right. Go ahead and quote that for us.
Godliness with contentment is great gain.
Mm-hmm.
And that really is a good point in our lives, and to put that with food and clothing and primarily godliness with those is really a great gain in our lives.
Mm-hmm. See, that's 1 Timothy 6:6. There's great gain in godliness with contentment. You see, he's talking about these fellows who are teaching some false things, and he says they imagine that godliness is a means of gain. See, godliness is a means of gaining money. Yes?
I have this insight about the Lord, when there is over here, he provides everything for us. Why should we have a need of want of anything? And if we ask him, thus don't ask him, he will give to us if
sure.
we ask him.
Absolutely.
If we need us, we will have it.
Yeah, in Matthew 6:33, he says, but seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be yours as well. And what's he talking about when he says these things?
Food and clothing.
You know, it always bothered me. I can understand maybe that transportation is not in that, because we've got pretty good transportation here with our feet. But one thing that bothered me is housing is never included in that. Just food and clothing, you know?
I see the clothing define broader.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, because
I see.
The circumstance of the world that you're in, to be close from the elements.
I see. Okay, it's not just...
I've applied a broader application.
That's a good thought. I'd always taken it just to be a button-down collar and a suit.
Instead of this past winter, you know, with the 30 below zero.
Yeah.
Area, you know, that's
when it's nice to be in Texas.
Sure.
Okay, what are some hindrances to contentment? Well, there's nothing new under the sun when it comes to Satan and how he tries to trip us up. If you look at 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 and 16, you'll see there three hindrances to contentment. First John 2, 15 and 16. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, love for the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, number one, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the boastful pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. So we pick up three things here. Lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and pride of life. My spiritual father calls that indulgence, indulge, impress, and possess. You indulge the lust of the flesh, you try to impress people with the boastful pride of life, and you try to possess the lust of the eyes. Another message I heard on this one time called it passions, possessions, and positions. Passions, possessions, and positions. Another one I heard one time called it gratification, gold, and glory. Gratification, gratifying the desires of the flesh. Lust of the eyes would be gold. And then pride of life would be glory. Now, I said there's nothing new under the sun. And this is the way Satan tried to tempt Eve. It was in Moses' life. It's the same way Satan came at Jesus, and I don't see any change in his strategy. I believe it's the way he comes at us, to rob us of our contentment, which robs us of abundant life, coming in and out and having pasture. Now, it's worth looking, I think, in Genesis 3, just to see how Satan is going to try to trip us up on these things. Genesis chapter 3. Let me just read this and see if you can pick out lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and pride of life. Genesis 3:6. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate, and she also gave some to her husband, and he ate. All right, now tell me, what is lust of the flesh? Good for food. All right, good. Lust of the eyes. Pleasing to the eye. Pride of life. Desirable for making one wise or gaining wisdom. Right there in one fell swoop, lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life. All right, let's check out Moses. We'll leave Moses in Hebrews. Actually, we could run through the Old Testament and get Moses, but it's summarized for us in Hebrews, which makes it kind of nice. Hebrews 11, 24 to 26. Okay, let me read the verse, and you pick them out for me. By faith, this is 24, by faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to share ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered abuse suffered for the Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he looked to the reward. Okay? Can you give me the pride of life? To be called the son. I mean, hey, that's position. That's been pressed in people. I'm the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Mm-hmm. Boastful pride of life. Okay, how about lust of the flesh?
Enjoy the pleasures of sin.
The fleeting pleasures of sin, lust of the flesh. And hey, you know, those onions and garlics and leeks back there in Egypt, you know, those things are good. A friend of mine said the problem with Christians is they don't really know how to sin and enjoy it. He said, you know, if you're going to sin, just do it right and really enjoy it, you know, really get after it.
Mm-hmm.
And how about lust of the eyes? Yeah, the greater wealth of the treasures in Egypt. Eh? Nothing new under the sun. Eve, Moses. Now let's look at Jesus in Matthew 4. Three through 11 is kind of a long passage. Let me just hit a few key ones here and see if I can prejudice you into agreeing with me. The tempter came and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, command these stones to become bread." But Jesus answered, "It is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God." What do you think that is? Lust of the flesh. Hey, you can get two of them there, really. You're the Son of God. Just turn those stones into bread. So he's really trying to get it. Well, I hadn't thought about that until just now. It hit me. That's pride of life and lust of the flesh. Then the devil took him to the holy city and set him on the pinnacle, which, by the way, was about 400 feet above the top. It was about, four stories up. And said to him, 40 stories, 10 feet a story. Yeah, 40 stories. That'd make it in downtown Hartford, wouldn't it? And said to him, "If you're the Son of God, or since you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will give his angels charge over you, and on their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone." Jesus said again, "It is written, don't tempt the Lord your God." What do you have there? Yeah, pride of life. I mean, wouldn't that be impressive? You know, you just jump off this 40-story building and hear these angels come down and just kind of let you down. You just kind of like a skydiver. You just touch your feet down, see? Pride of life, impression. Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain, showed him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them, and said to him, "All these I will give you if you will fall down and worship me." Right. Well, but showing him all the kingdoms of the world, said, "I'll give you all this." Lust of the eyes. Okay? So we have to watch for these things. Okay? We have to watch for these things because they will rob us of our contentment, and when we're robbed of contentment, we're robbed of abundant life. And Jesus came to suffer, to serve, suffer, and save so that we could have eternal and abundant life. Okay, now, what does the Bible have to say about money? Okay, I'm going to hit the high spots here. I'm not going to cover each one of these in detail. You can read. You can look up those passages. Let me just pick a couple of them out. Some of them I'll make some comments about. Others I'll just skip over or mention briefly. Let's go back to 1 Timothy 6:10. That's a good one. That's a key passage here. These false teachers who don't teach what Jesus said and who don't teach according to godliness, boy, listen to these guys. They're puffed up with conceit. They know nothing. They have a morbid craving for controversy, disputes about words, which result in envy, dissension, slander, base suspicions, and wrangling among men, depraved in mind and bereft of the truth, imagining that godliness is what? A way to get gain. Now, there is great gain in godliness with contentment, you see. For we brought nothing into the world, and it is certain that we cannot take anything out of the world. But if we have food and clothing, with these we shall be content. But those who desire, you see, who are not content, who covet or desire to be rich, fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all evils. It is through this craving, this desiring, this coveting, that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced their hearts with many acute mental pangs, is the idea there. So what is money? It's the root of all evil.
No, the love of it.
Oh, you mean there's a difference there? Yeah, there's a difference between money being a root of all evil and the love of money being a root of all evil. Money is just a medium of exchange, I guess, if we were teaching economics here. It doesn't make or break us. It simply reveals us. Are we content with it, or do we covet it and try to get it? You see.
What I got a hold of that one time was that a lot of times when we save the money, it's ruining people. What we're really doing is, like the alcoholic says, it was the liquor.
That's right.
And we're putting the blame on the money, and it's really not.
Yeah. It's lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and pride of life. For the alcoholic, it's lust of the flesh. Okay, whose is it? The gold is mine, the silver is mine, the cattle on 1,000 hills. Every beast of the forest is mine. God is not impressed with how much money anybody has. Now, what does God plan to do with our money? Well, to provide our needs. And my God will supply every need, not want, every need of yours according to his riches in Christ Jesus. There are some people in the United States who are genuinely poor. The neighborhood I live in Fort Worth, the median income in Fort Worth is $26,000. The median income where I live is $44,000. And many houses have two of those per house. Very affluent region. Make and do in my neighborhood is not having a color TV in the bedroom for the kids. And if you don't have a Mercedes and a sprinkler system and a pool, you're in real trouble. And my daughter has got a bad case of wanting me to keep up with the Joneses so she can have stuff. So we're a long way from making do, and most of us in the United States. Now, there are some people who have genuine needs. And there's some of those in our church, and they live in very tough circumstances. But most of us are a long way from making do. God has promised to supply our needs. It shows God's power to bless us. It trains us. Deuteronomy 14:23 in the living. Sometimes it's interesting to go to the living to get a little bit different twist on these things. 14:23 in the living says, the purpose of tithing is to teach you to always put God first in your lives. It says, bring this tithe to eat before the Lord your God at the place he shall choose as his sanctuary. This applies to your tithes of grain, new wine, olive oil, and the firstborn of your flocks. And the purpose of this is to train you or teach you to always put God first in your lives. So it trains us. Money allows us to bless others. We can be financially free. John, in 8:36, it says, so if the Son makes you free, you're free indeed. That may be a good definition of abundant life, being free indeed. A lot of people, though, are in what kind of bondage? Financial bondage. Now, how can you tell if you're in financial bondage? Well, are you in debt? Do you have a lot of indebtedness? If you sold everything and wound up out in the street with clothes on your back, how would it wash out?
You're
dead. Yeah. No, if you wound up with something, you wouldn't be. See, a lot of people have a lot of stuff, but if they washed everything out, sold all their stuff, and paid all their bills, they'd get out there with a suit. Just about like I would, but, you know, they've got a lot more stuff than I do. They also owe a lot more. Do you have the constant pressure of bills? I can remember before I committed my life to Jesus Christ, I used to sit down every month and it was just kind of flip a coin and pay this one, you know, and I just juggle those things around, about $5,000 on two or three different 4, 5, 6 credit cards, and pay this one $17 this month and this one $13 this month, and hope I could get them all, you know, and I'm running around with all these things trying to juggle these bills every month. Are you obsessed with business? Is that all you talk about? Are you trying to get rich quick? Do you have a concern for temporal things? This is one of the things that Peter rebuked Simon for in Acts chapter 8. He had some rather harsh words for him there, by the way. He said what? You got another thing coming, don't you? That's exactly right. You bet. Simon saw the Spirit was given through the laying on of hands. He offered money. Give me this power. that whom I lay my hands on may also receive the Holy Spirit. But Peter said to him, your silver perish with you because you thought you could obtain the gift of God with your money. You have neither part nor lot in this matter, for your heart is not right before God. Repent, therefore, of this wickedness of yours, and pray to the Lord that, if possible, the intent of your heart may be given, for I see that you are in the gall of bitterness and in the bond of iniquity. Simon prayed, pray for me to the Lord that nothing of what you said may come upon me. So, yeah, are we concerned with temporal values? Do we have an inability to learn from past mistakes? I learned from a mistake one time. I moved out of a house and bought a second house before I sold the first house. I will never do that again. I learned from that mistake, but you know, if I got this deal, you know, it's Cullen Davis's 19,000 square foot mansion, and it's $6 million, and we're gonna let you have it for only 2.8, and you have to buy it before midnight. See, okay, I'll take it. So I buy them. Here I am with this $2 million mansion, and I haven't sold this $51,000 one yet. You see, I've learned no matter how good the deal is, I'm not buying another house until I sell this one. That's bondage, or at least it is for me.
Excuse me, but if you sell one, let's say, like I'm thinking, I lost my husband, thinking of selling my single home to go in a two-family, I would rather try to find a two-family first before I make sure I find a good home before I sold my
Well, now, is the one you're in paid for?
Yep.
Oh, okay, that's another.
That's like
equity.
Yeah, I wouldn't have any problem with that. The problem I had was I was making two house payments, see. And you just can't, my budget won't absorb two house payments.
Well, I would have to mortgage my house with the money to pay for the other house.
I'd be careful about that. I don't want to get two bills going. You might take a contingency thing on it, you know, where you'll buy here once this one sells, yeah. Something like that.
Just
and you know, you may have, I don't know, you may have $1 million in the bank where you could afford to make the two house payments. You see, you have to evaluate your overall situation, but two house payments killed me. Wiped out all my savings.
The only way I would find would be like a two or three family that would have bringing income of its own.
Sure. Yeah. And I think that's probably a good deal. Well, learn from these past mistakes. How can you tell if you're financially free? Well, do you have bills that are past due? Are you particularly vulnerable to financial pressure? What are your priorities? Do you have some emergency funds? Would some sort of an emergency wipe you out? You know, if the water heater breaks and floods the house and you have to come up with $2,000 for carpet, can you come up with it, or do you have to hang the carpet out on the line for to dry out? See? Yes.
What does it mean, undue vulnerability to financial pressure? In other words, you're not juggling your bills?
That's right.
You're able to meet your bills.
You're able to meet your bills. And if something which started to... if you got into some financial pressures, would that cause you problems? In other words, all of us can face pressures. For example, recently my wife comes in and she said, I think there's something wrong with the car. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, there's this, every time I take off, there's this big ball of steam that goes out the back of it, see? One of the heads had warped, and the head gasket had broken, and there was water getting down in the piston, and it was so all the water was just going right out of the radiator into the piston, and it was burning up, and it was coming out the tailpipe of steam. See, well, that's about a $500 or $600 deal, and that's a financial pressure. But I had the money set aside in a fund for car repair, and so I was not vulnerable to that pressure. On the other hand, if I hadn't had that $575.12 or whatever it was to get the car fixed, I would have thought, man, that's a lot of money. What I better do is get rid of this old clunker and trade it in, see? And then I'll only have a $500 payment every month for 42 months, see? Now, that's a good deal. But having that $500 over here to take care of it, that makes too much sense to... You see what I'm saying? In other words, I was not. That was a financial pressure, but I was not vulnerable to it.
You
to do something that would really get me in a jam. In fact, just recently in Fort Worth, I don't know if you all heard about this or not, but there's a billionaire there, one of the Texas billionaires, Cullen Davis and his brother Ken Davis. He had this 19,000 square foot mansion, and there were several people killed there a number of years ago, and he had three different trials over it. It's been a kind of a major thing there. But he just recently declared bankruptcy on one of his... He has 131 corporations or something, but one of them, Ken Davis Industries, just recently declared bankruptcy. Now, here's a billionaire, but he had $400 million in notes to banks that he couldn't pay. The banks called the notes in. He was paying the interest on them. He just couldn't make the payment, and they wanted their $400 million, and so now he's in bankruptcy. And so that's been kind of a thing around Fort Worth there. But this friend of mine, it took me to the airport. We were kind of talking about these things, and he said, I asked him how he builds these 47-story buildings. That's his. He's in the construction business and puts in the ceilings and the walls. And I asked him how he'd come through this last slump, and he said, you know, when you don't have any notes at the bank, it's a whole lot easier to ride out those slumps. He said, we just don't have any notes at the bank, and I think everything's going to come out all right. Interestingly enough, he's been a Christian now about 6 years, and it's taken him a while to get his finances arranged. And he told me, he called me on the phone. I'm kind of his spiritual advisor. He calls me on the phone, and he says, he just tells me, he's a businessman. He says, I want you to find out how I can give some money in Ethiopia. He said, I've been reading about that, I've seen it on TV, I'm concerned about it, and I want you to find out who I need to give my money to so that it'll get to those people and help them. That's number five, a concern for God's work. Very few people who are financially in bondage are concerned about giving and helping other people. Number six, which goes back with an inability to learn from past mistakes, is an ability to learn from past mistakes. We got an opportunity to build from the ground up a brand new house. The builder gave us probably a half to a third of what his normal fee is. We had a friend draw up the plans. We were all set to go. And where we live is about 95% developed. The word was around that lots were going to double from like 25,000 to 40 or 45,000. And so we put our sign out in the front yard. And we find one addition that's got four streets in it that's got about 12 lots left. $22,000 for these lots. I don't have $22,000. Do I go over there and buy that? I can't even make the payments on $22,000, much less a whole new house. One of Fran's aunts died, and her half of the inheritance, with our savings, just about paid for the lot. So we went ahead and bought the lot. Well, then you get a little itchy. You see, you want to build a house. But I'm thinking, wait a minute now, dummy. This 12 years ago, you got a deal on this house, and you didn't sell this one, and you bought this one. Then you had two you had to pay for.
Learning from your past experiences.
Proverbs 24:9, and I'll get some verification on this here. Proverbs 24:9 says, the devising of folly is sin. And I was praying one morning, Lord, what have I done wrong here? I've already spent my life savings. I can't continue to make these double house payments. Well, Proverbs 24:9, the Lord says, the devising of folly is sin, and the scoffer is an abomination to men. Out beside that, I wrote get rich quick schemes. And Niels, would you just tell them what I've got written right down there?
Denton House?
Yeah, moving to Fort Worth before selling the Denton House. See? Denton's a little town north of Fort Worth. So I learned from that, but here's this itch, you see. Lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and pride of life. I want to get over there and get started building this house. Lot's paid for through the inheritance. Plans are drawn up. Good deal from the builder. Boy, I've got all these super ideas, you know, how I'm going to insulate it and get it energy efficient. We're excited. How long do you think that sign sits out in the front yard before we sell our house? 18 months. 18 months. But I was not going to make the same mistake again. Interestingly enough, we made a lot of changes to the house in those 18 months, and on a scale from 1 to 10, it probably moved it from around a 6 or a 6.5 to about a 9.8. Little things like switches and all this kind of thing. But I was willing to learn from those past mistakes. Okay, what are some other things that the Bible teaches us about money? It can be a blessing. It can be harmful. Now, what can it cause us to do? Well, it can cause us to forget God. The Bible says, but you shall remember the Lord your God that who gives you the power to get wealth. It can cause us to stop trusting God. It can cause us to be deceived. You know, in the parable of the sower, it talks about the deceitfulness of riches. Back to 1 Timothy 6:10, it can cause us to do what? The love of money is the root of all evil. It can cause us to fall in love with it. It can cause us to rest on an unstable foundation. It can cause us to become ungrateful. Some of the most ungrateful people that I know are some of the wealthiest. Just have no thankfulness or gratefulness for what they have. Some of the happiest people, this family in our Sunday school class, I mean, they don't. All they have can be put in a car, literally. I went over the other day to help them move. They've been evicted from their apartment. Everything they had fit in that car. And man, here's my daughter and her gang out here, and they're wondering about, you know, well, am I going to get a 85 Camaro, or do I need one of those Pontiac Fieros, you know, when I turn 16? This stuff of getting one when you get out of high school, getting the second car, that's just not acceptable anymore in her circles. You got to get one when you're 16, brand new. Really, the acceptable thing is to have your parents lie for you and get one at 15 on a hardship license. A Porsche. And these kids, this all moaning and groaning around, I went over and here these little kids, man, they don't have anything. Just happy as they can be. And here these kids got these swimming pools and sprinkler systems and Mercedes, just as ungrateful as they can be.
You met a fellow like that recently. He inherited $5 million. He was the most unhappy man in the world.
And ungrateful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it can cause... Yeah. Yeah. It'll cause us to become ungrateful, cause us to become proud, also get greedy. Jesus said, take heed and beware of all covetousness, for a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions, Luke 12:15.
You know, there's a young teenager that committed suicide down in Texas.
Oh, yeah.
Did you contribute that to the, some of that, from the not being contented, over-gratification,
over... Yeah, that's in a suburb over in Plano. Just it's in North Dallas, probably less than 40 miles from where I live. I'm sure there's a complex number of things involved in that, but I'm sure that's part of it. They've been given everything you can have. What else is left?
So,
yeah. What else is left? Yes.
I had a privilege one time of cleaning the house for a family where Toby and Nicky Nicholson in Simsbury. We're living in about $250,000 home, and the father has a seat on the New York Stock Exchange, and the mother's a bank. And I met these little boys, and I had to clean up their toys in the basement. And I was irate to have to go clean up toys for little kids. But I cleaned up the toys, and the Lord said, you go talk to them, tell them about me. So I told them about the Lord. And they just knew he was born on Christmas, and they didn't really know who he was. And the Lord was saying, this one boy said, I said, don't you ever clean up your room or anything? And there's Toby, the other one. And he said, nobody's ever shown me how. And the Lord said, hear what he's saying. Nobody cares enough.
Mm-hmm.
So I took him in the library, and they had a Bible there. And I cracked it. It had never been read. Sitting up there, gathering dust. And I led him to the Lord, and I let him read the first chapter of the Gospel of John.
That's fantastic.
What a joy. I walked back to sales and sold that, and I said, I was upset with you yesterday. I thank you.
Yeah.
Toys for any kids you ever want, but But what they were screaming out was saying, nobody cares now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nobody cares now.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because a lot of these people, not all, Lord forbid, of great wealth, what happens is they're so involved in social activities and all these other different kinds of activities, the Lions Club and whatnot, trying to, I guess, find a place where they belong. It's and meanwhile, fun. They tend to abandon their main purpose, which is their children.
Amen.
Okay? Because that.
Said in 2 Thessalonians, if you don't work, you don't eat. As I mentioned before, you don't need to try to make money for Jesus or to help God out. He owns the cattle on 1,000 hills, and all the silver and all the gold is His. That's not a proper motive. Doing something is better than doing nothing. Sometimes we'll have someone that we know who loses their job. One fellow, for example, lost his job. He was an executive, and he was out of work quite a while. And he just kind of sat around and read the Wall Street Journal, sent out a few resumes. Another fellow sat around and read the Wall Street Journal, sent out resumes, but he did that at night, and in the daytime, he worked on the freight docks loading trucks. So doing something is better than doing nothing. Whatever you do, work hard. Whatever your task, work heartily as serving the Lord and not men, it says in Colossians 3:23. Now, this is something that's kind of interesting. One of the statistics they gave us about Hartford, and I think it was 57% of the women work, something like that, very high. And my wife has worked and not worked and worked part-time, and we've been on all different sides of this, but let me just pose a couple of things about here is whether or not it's worth it to have two incomes in the family. Is it really worth it on the bottom line? And there's other things on the bottom line besides money. It puts you in a higher tax bracket, and you may not wind up netting out as much, especially when you take off the cost of child care, the extra cost of lunches and transportation and fast food suppers. It can also lower the husband's self-esteem. It can cause health and emotional problems because of the additional stress. Very few women have affairs who take care of things at home. There's just something about being in an office situation 8 hours a day with somebody that is not conducive to faithfulness. Will the quality of family life suffer? If you have Kentucky Fried, y'all have Kentucky Fried Chicken up here?
Yeah.
If you have Kentucky Fried Chicken every night, you see, and the wife comes in and the man's not there and the kids just eat it off the counter, you know, what's happening to the quality of family life? And I think one of the things that was shared with me one time is to examine what the motives are. Is the real reason that the wife is working is because either the wife or the husband, and notice that word there, is not content with their circumstances. Is that the real reason? Now, I know there are many special circumstances and all kinds of problems involved in this. All I'm suggesting is to take a look at it and see if it's really worth it, all things considered and taken together. I know one fellow I work with, he's just decided that his wife's not going to work, and as a result, they have not eaten out in, I don't know, 8 or 10 years. But that's just a choice they've made and a commitment they have. Yeah. I don't know. They live in a pretty nice neighborhood. All right. What about now that that we've talked about earning it, how about saving it? How do you save money?
We're paying attention.
All right. One way to save money is to pay yourself first. In other words, take it off the top. Now, when we get to giving, notice that I've under giving down here, I'm going to say pay God first. Now, what that means is take your giving and your saving right off the top. Pay those two things first. By the way, there's one thing that comes off the top, and that's what? Taxes. Yeah. Yeah. See that comes off. Yeah, that comes off the top. See. Yeah. How else can you save? Well, you can save by paying cash. Another way you can save is by putting a certain coin, like a quarter or whatever, or just all your change in a box, This businessman that I was telling you about that took me to the airport this morning, he saved over $1,000. Every time he comes in, he just pitches his change in a shoebox. Now, don't tell your wife and kids I tried this, and they found out I had this mug, you see. Boy, I had that thing about half full, and it just kind of went down. One. What happened? Well, we decided we wanted to go to McDonald's, and so there went my brother-in-law. And by the way, he said that he took that thing to the bank the other day, and there was over $1,000 in there. He'd been saving it for several years just out of his change each day when he comes in. My brother-in-law saved $1,000 like that and bought a little home computer with it. And just recently we were down in Houston for a birthday party, and he gave his son the shoebox with his change in it. Well, his son and my son got together and started counting something like $320 in that shoebox, just pitching that change in there, see. Another way to do this is to preserve windfalls. Now, what is a windfall? Okay? Unexpected money. You get an IRS return. They're assuring us we're still going to get those, but I don't know how that's going to work out. An expense check. An insurance check. I know book salesmen come by occasionally and buy used books from me. Another fellow came by and said, if you'll give me the names of people on this campus who are interested in a certain kind of retirement program and just tell them I'm coming by, then I'll give you a referral fee. A friend of mine gave me an oil well. I get $35 a month on that oil well. Well, I could take $35 a month and get my wife and another couple, and we could go out to eat and spend the $35 pretty easy. But I take those kinds of little things and just put them aside, and I do it in cash in an envelope. And when I checked that cash, when I checked that envelope just recently, there was over $700 in there that had come in, you know, 30, 50. Book reviews. Occasionally I'll get a manuscript from a publisher and they want me to review the manuscript. They'll send me $200, $300 for that, you see. And I just keep those kinds of monies. And those are examples of windfalls. Why save? Well, tied back to some other principles. To have a margin, be prepared for emergencies. In other words, is it $500 for a repair now or $500 a month for the next 42 months? To be able to help others. This guy calls me, I was telling you about in our Sunday school class, the one who, everything they've got, literally they can put in their car. He calls me and he says, I was wondering if you could, and I could tell it was hard for him, he said, I was wondering if you could help me out a little bit. So what do you mean? He said, well, something got fouled up on my check and I'm a little bit short on money. And I said, well, what do you need? And he said, well, just some groceries and gasoline. I said, okay, I'll tell you what, I'll come over and buy you a tank of gas and buy such some groceries. So I got reached in my little $700 thing there and pulled out about $40 and just took it over and handed it to him. Well, if I'd been pressed, I wouldn't have had that money to help him. I'd have missed that blessing, you see. So you have to watch that. Now, spending money. Plan. Have a plan that will work if you can work it. Make sure it doesn't work you. Yeah. List needs in order of importance. Now, tie that down with, I'll give you an example of that. List needs in order of importance. Tie that down with F, which says give each member of the family, involve the whole family in planning the budget. One of the things I did one time, I figured up how much money I brought home, and I think it was about $1,200 a month at that time. And so I went to the bank, I got 1,200 pennies. And I came home and I piled 1,200 pennies out on the table and I said, now, and the kids were younger then, and I said, how much of that do you think we have to spend for groceries each month? And how much for a telephone, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it was kind of interesting, you know, to see those pennies get all spread out over the table, and they played with it a little while, and then I showed them what was going, how we were spending it. So involve the whole family. One of the things we just did recently, we decided that my daughter needs a car, we need a sprinkler system, and we need a computer. Yeah? Now,
all those needs.
Need, absolutely. All right, so we got together and I said, okay, I want everybody to list with a number one what you think the first thing we ought to get, and then a two, and then a three, and then we'll average those up, and whoever gets the lowest score, that's the one we'll get first, and we're not getting any of them until we get the money. Well, we got this opportunity to buy. And the neat thing, see, you either got to have an 85 Camaro, or 86, whichever one's the latest one out, or you got to have a 65 Mustang. I mean, that's it. So I got this opportunity to buy a 67 Mustang, which is remote. It's just a little bit acceptable, for about half what the market price is, because it was tied up in some legal problems. The guy had gone to the penitentiary and didn't pay his lawyer, and so the lawyer took his car, and the bail bondsman had a claim on it, but I was assured I could get a good deal on it. Clear title.
If you could do it by midnight.
If I could do it by midnight. But at any rate, when I got up there and got the price of the car, I had just gotten my income tax return that day, and it was within $50. It was $44 more than the price of the car.
Wow.
So we got the car, and that was the first thing. Now, we're still waiting for the sprinkler system and the
the smoke detector.
Yeah. Okay, discontinue any services not needing and apply the savings in another area in the budget. I know people who spend $20, $30, $40, even $50 a month on cable TV subscriptions and newspapers. Just a little thing like that, and you really don't need them. You don't need to take three papers, you know, and you don't need all those movie channels, etc. Let me give you an illustration here. This one is particularly meaningful to me. We borrowed $55,000 on this house at 13% for 30 years. That works out to be, in round figures, $600 a month for 30 years. Now, if I pay that out in 30 years, I think I pay something like... I think it's $216 is what it works out to, something like that. But my son's got braces. $80 I'm paying on these braces for 12 more months. And then after that 12 months, see, that's a service that I don't need any longer and I can put it somewhere else. If I put that $80 onto that house payment, I shorten that 30-year note to 15.
Really, that much?
Half. It cuts $80 a month, cuts it from 30 to 15. It saves me something like $92,000. In other words, it only costs me like $110 instead of $110,000 for 55 instead of $210,000 or $220,000. Now, here's the real catch. If I start taking that $680 every month after 15 years, and put it in every month, guess how much I'll have at the end of 30 years?
$374,000.
Wow. All just by discontinuing the braces, and not, I'm finishing the braces, but I'm taking that $80, a little discipline, putting it on the house, you see? If I could double that house payment from $600 to $1,200, I could shorten that house payment from 30 years to 5 years. Don't ever overlook just another $25 a month on the principal on a mortgage over a long period of time. It will add up.
Excuse me. Somebody did suggest, I know my husband and you were thinking about it, it's a property at the Catskills, and I think a 30-year mortgage compared to a 15-year mortgage, so this may be like a difference of $50 a payment. Would you recommend 15 years or 30 years and try to bring it down to 15?
Well, I think either one of those is fine. The counsel I had was to go with the 15. Now, I'll tell you why I went with the 30. Because if I ever just got my back to the wall and it came down to $80 a month, if I'm on the 30-year, I've got the $80. But if I'm on the 15, then I don't have the $80. The negative aspect of it is it takes more discipline on my part to pay $80 on a 30-year note extra than it does to pay the $80 on a 15-year note. So I picked the 30-year note, but I think there's good arguments both ways. I'm sure the road is good intentions on paying for these things. Well, let's see if we can hit some high spots here. Know what your cash flow is. If you spend 50 cents a day on a Coke, that's $15 a month. Carry a little 3x5 card around and write down for a month every penny you spend. Now, that takes a little discipline. But you will be amazed. You know what the number one item in your budget will be? M-I-S-C. Miscellaneous. That's exactly right. Get a handle on what that cash flow is. Just some other ways to stay out of traps. Don't loan money at interest. Give it away. Don't co-sign notes. Don't go into debt for items that depreciate. Proverbs 22:7 says, the rich rule over the poor and the borrower is the slave of the lender. My daddy says you can't borrow your way out of debt, and if you pay for things, you won't ever owe anybody for anything. Pretty wise old man. I remember driving past in 1973 when gas was 50 cents a gallon at the credit card station. I was driving past a cash station where it was 34 cents. One day it dawned on me, why am I spending 15 cents a gallon more to use a credit card? So I canned my gas company credit cards. Be patient, wait for God to provide. And just because you can jump out of an airplane and God can keep you from smashing into the ground does not mean that He's promised to do that. You shall not tempt the Lord your God. Just because God can do it doesn't mean that He will. Buy wisely. Be patient. Shop around. Know the market. I can tell you what the price of Mustangs is in Houston, Longview, Texas, and California. They're about $2,000 in Longview, about $4,000 in DFW, about $3,000 in Houston, and about $10,000 in California. For the same identical cost.
So you drive your $2,000.
There are people. There are actually dealers. There are actually dealers in the Dallas-Fort Worth area from California who are just walking up. This guy told me the story. Who are walking up to people with these Mustangs. There's a whole subculture. I didn't even know about this. It's kind of grown up around these things. I'm getting a real education. Yeah. They just offer to buy them right on the spot. I'll give you $2,500 for it, cash.
They know they can
drive it to California and sell it for $6,000 or $10,000, depending on the shape it's in. So know what the market is. Build sales resistance. Don't buy impulsively. A friend of mine goes around and he says, boy, I'm glad I don't need that. Man, think how much money I'm saving by not buying that. I heard a radio talk show of a guy one time who'd made $1 million in the stock market, and he just had one simple rule. He said, I never buy anything on the day that it occurs to me. He said, I always wait till the next day and sleep on it. And then he says, it's a lot less pressing the next day. He said that was his number one rule in the stock market. Get the facts, like Solomon said when the two women came with the baby, you know. He said, now wait a minute here, let's get the facts. Does this thing do what it claims to do? Don't buy a word processing program for $275 if it won't do underlining. There are those kind, you know. Will it use it enough to justify the expense? A friend of mine calculated that at his current rate of usage and the current value of his ski boat that it was costing him $100 every time he took it to the lake. And that's just on the just purchase price and selling price. He was throwing $100 in the lake every time he went out there. That doesn't count gas, oil, and maintenance. So do you use it enough to warrant the use of it or warrant the expense of it? Am I buying more than I need? A friend of mine has a Ford agency there in the DFW area, and I said, Joe, why does somebody buy a $40,000 Mercedes when a $25,000 Cadillac will do just as well? In fact, a $15,000 Buick will get the job done. Why do they do that? I was interested in why car dealers think people do that. He said, well, they're just trying to make a statement. I've got a 1966 Ford pickup truck.
You're making a statement.
I'm making a statement. My daughter says, she won't even get near it. She calls her friends to apologize when I come to pick her up in this thing, see? I'm making a statement. I said, everybody's got these Mercedes. They run around everywhere.
Yeah.
I'm the only one with a 66 Ford pickup truck with 240,000 miles on it. Nobody in all DFW's got one like that. I've got one. I'm making a statement. Will a used one that's only, you know, $6,000 or $8,000 do just as good as one of these $40,000? All right. Here's a little chant I want to give you here. Number 6. Use it up, wear it out, make it do or do without. Have you got that? Let's try it. That's an oldie but a goodie. Use it up, wear it out, make it do or do without. Good. Giving, take it off the top, pay God first. We are responsible for how we manage our money. Where should we give? Let those who are taught the word share all good things with him who teaches. Give to the poor. As a matter of fact, in Deuteronomy 14:28, it says the whole tithe, the third year, should be used for local welfare programs, helping the poor.
What's that in Deuteronomy
14:28 in the Living.
The third year?
Yep. To other congregations who are having hard times. In fact, every example and every command in the New Testament to give is related to helping another congregation who is having more problems than you are. Where will the investment produce the best turn? Now, are people responding positively to the message and being helped? Well, now, what do you mean helped? Are you helping them do what they want to do? Are you helping them get to the point where they can help you do what you want to? See, a lot of organizations will help people with the idea that then those people will become financial supporters of the organization. Now, certainly, let him who has taught the word share all good things with him who teaches is valid, but my motivation for teaching would not be so that you'll share all good things with me. Do you follow? Okay. Is there a standard of excellence along with a freedom from waste? Now, why give? God commands it. It's good for you. It's more blessed to give than receive. Acts 20:35. Others receive a blessing. A friend of mine today said friend wouldn't let him pay for something, because, and he tried to, and he said, "You're not going to rob me of the blessing. I'm paying for it." Now, what is the amount and attitude of giving? Well, I'll tell you, you don't want to go by the Old Testament.
You're going to wipe
you out. You get
32%.
That's the maximum. The 2% is negotiable. It's questionable whether or not that third 10% is a full 10 or is just 10 of the remaining 80. But any way you slice that, it's a bunch, right? Told my Sunday school class recently, we had a lesson on tithing. I said, when I finish with you today, you'll be begging to get back to 10%. So you want to talk tithe? We're going to talk exactly what the book says. The book says somewhere between 22 and 32. In the New Testament, it's regular and proportionate, cheerful, and generous. Now, if you run out of money, what could be some of the causes? Well, maybe you didn't really need it. God might be testing your faith. You may have misspent money that he's already provided.
Excuse me, what are you saying is proper tithing? How much?
Every man according as he purposeth in his own heart, so let him give, not grudgingly or of necessity, but cheerful for God.
I don't know, that scripture where God says, you give to the church, but you don't provide for the widows or
Mark 7,
the home,
yeah.
You know?
And many
that's where I feel your priorities first.
If any man does, yeah, 1 Timothy 5:8. If any man does not provide for his own relatives and especially for his own family, he has disowned the faith. 1 Timothy 5:7. He has disowned the faith and is worse than an unbeliever.
Would that include like college education and stuff?
Well, you know, if you're sending them to Brown, you know where Brown University is. You're sending them to Brown. That's one thing. If they're living at home and going locally, and it's all you can do to pay the local tuition, that's another thing. First Timothy 5:8. If anyone does not provide for his own,
Mark 7.
The first one you gave her when she asked what was the title. How much are you saying?
Oh, 2 Timothy 9, 6 and 7. But in, I believe it's Mark 7 where Jesus gets on the Pharisees. Look, just write this down. Mark 7. Look at about 5 through 13. Mark 7, 5 through 13. Jesus speaks to the issue there of using money, giving money, legalistic religious use of money as opposed to taking it from your family.
Isn't
another verse in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 2.
Right.
It says, on the first day of the week, let each one of you lay something aside, stirring up as he may prosper, that there be no collection of
As you prosper and as you purpose in your own heart. Now, by the way, that 1 Corinthians 16:1, he's saying, do that so that when I come to get that gift to take back to this other congregation, you won't have to take special offering when I get there. You read it and check me out and see if that's not right. Now, the other thing, you may have violated a biblical principle: stingy, hasty, stubborn, lazy, drunk, gluttony, craftiness. Look up these scriptures, check out what I say, whether they be so or not, and may God prosper you. Thank you.